In the 1970s, a future, top-notch podcasting team was born, and then raised on military bases because their dads were in the Air Force. These Gen Xers eventually grew up and were unleashed upon the world. Today, looking forward to retirement, they survive by dishing out their opinions. If you have questions that need answers and an open mind, if you can spare 60 minutes a week, and if you have internet access, maybe you can listen to Kenyetta and Jack Save the World.
Help yourself to a cracker with a spread of cheddar cheese. Have a neck bone. You don't have to say please. Eat what you like. Eat what you like. Listening friends, take Digital Underground's advice. Eat what you like, do what you like, because we all should. Life is too short. And in case you missed it, yes, that was a lyric from Digital Underground's 1989 hit, Do What You Like. And for those of you who dabble in the hip-hop arena, you also know that is the group that the late, great Tupac Shakur got his start from. So, and it also gives you a little bit of hint on what we'll be discussing for today's episode, but I won't spoil it, so let's just get it going. Hi, Jack. What do you have?
Well, you know, I just have stuff and things, as usual. Stuff and things. But, yeah, I think we should get straight into the OWTF so we can talk about the greatness that is our theme of the month, folks. It's of the month. This isn't a one-week thing. It is a month thing.
30 days.
We're both excited about it. I guess it's... Is it my turn for WTS first? I lost track.
Doing that.
I lost tracks years ago.
Pretty much.
Anyway, mine is alumnus of the show, U.S. Representative Lauren Boebert, who has spent several years now talking about the Biden crime family that doesn't exist and how President Biden needs to be held accountable for the acts of his son Hunter. So the other day, Representative Boebert went on X, Twitter, whatever, and posted about how Hunter Biden was horrible and awful and he committed all these crimes and he needed to be held accountable, and so the whole family, blah, 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 blah. And then 2 hours later, her son, Tyler Boebert, 18, was arrested on 15 additional or 15 misdemeanor counts, plus some felony charges of criminal possession of identification documents, i.e. stealing people's identities. He was in stolen cars, using stolen credit cards to buy stuff at stores. And in her statement, Lauren Boebert said that she loves her son and that he has been through some very difficult public challenges for a young man and the subject of attention that he didn't ask for.
No kidding.
That doesn't sound like something that she gives towards other people.
No, she's acting like she isn't the sole source of that embarrassment. But right. I digress.
Right? I mean... It's not like, you know, Hunter Biden's mom and sister died when he was, what, 2 or 3?
And something like that.
His dad entered the political world when he was 2 or 3. And then he had another sibling that was also had problems with drugs and alcohol. And then he had another sibling that died from cancer. But, you know, you can't let any of that stuff be considered for what he's gone through versus Tyler Boebert, who grew up relatively well off and didn't have any issues going on until he knocked his girlfriend up at 14. And his parents went through a divorce. But you know.
But you forgot his mother humiliating herself at the theater.
Oh, God dang it. You're right.
Yeah.
I forgot about that.
You know them kids at school. Let him have it. They let him have it over there.
Well, you know.
So, if anybody has room to act out, it might be him.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not condoning it. I'm just saying. Something tells me having her as a mother is not easy.
You think?
even before she showed up on the national stage, I'm pretty sure she was. I don't know why it comes to mind. She's Regina George's mom in Mean Girls. I'm the cool mom. No, though. You're not.
No, you're the insane mom. But anyway, yeah, I just found that whole thing kind of a chickens coming home to roost moment or whatever, because.
Like the elbow. It's the elbow calling the knee ashy.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. We all need lotion, so calm down.
Yeah. And she, you know, if the next time she makes something, says something about Biden, I would go, hey, if we're keeping score on counts being charged with, your son outnumbers mine by however many.
I mean, of course she'll shoot back with, well, these are kinds of things. He's 18. You would expect him to get into trouble. No, you would not.
Yeah, perhaps if you had a better parent.
Most parents of teenagers do not expect their children to do stuff like this.
That is true.
So she'll, you know, if it comes out at any point, she'll just try to minimize it.
Well, I mean, yeah, she already did. So there's that.
Mm-hmm. She'll probably just take his phone away and cut off the internet.
Right. Well, apparently taking his credit cards away isn't going to do anything for him.
I'm sorry. Once he makes bail and he gets back home, then, well, I'm sorry. He wouldn't have to make. He'll just be on a cognizance. I see this now.
You're probably more than correct. He's probably already out.
Probably.
I mean, it probably happened fairly quickly.
Shay, you're going to take that plea deal, you little shit.
Yep. Yep. That is true. Real quick, though, before I hand over the WTFs to you, this is something that I was actually kind of shocked to see happen in Oklahoma. But it's a good thing because it ties in with what we've discussed on this show many, many times. And a bill has made it out of committee in the Oklahoma State Senate that if it passes the House and the governor signs it after 10 years, as long as you have not had any further arrests, you've paid all the restitution that you owed and any fines or fees after 10 years, any misdemeanor crime of a certain category is automatically going to be expunged from your record in the state of Oklahoma.
That's shocking.
Yeah.
Apparently from a list sometime last year, in the middle of last year, the top 10 worst states to live in. First was Texas. Second was Oklahoma.
Yeah, living in Oklahoma, that does not surprise me at all.
I'm like, I feel horrible that the hometown has this reputation, but it really is just indicative of what the majority of the people care about, which is basically themselves, apparently.
Right.
And then I was reading somewhere, and I'm not even going to try to make sense of it, only to sum up that rural constituents have hold a heavier weight when it comes to voting, just based on the way that the Electoral College works. They may be fewer right. residents in certain rural areas, but they can still carry as many votes, let's say, with the same amount of votes that, let's say, a city with a population of 50,000 could.
Right.
It's very, and that's just one more argument against the Electoral College, which may be an episode down the road. But anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Oklahoma's weird. It's like three parts. There's the Oklahoma City Metro, there's the Tulsa Metro, and the rest of the state.
Pretty much. That's pretty much how you identify anything.
But yeah.
You know. Oh, I live in Broken Arrow. It's right outside of Tulsa. Matter of fact, I had like a virtual meeting some months ago with some of the it was like, it's a women's group within the division I work in.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a virtual meeting, and then they, you know how they like to do breakout rooms?
Yeah.
So there were like five or six of us in little breakout rooms. We were, you know, getting to know each other. And one of the ladies works at a branch up there in Tulsa. And she had just moved to Broken Arrow. I said, where do you stay at up there? Oh, in Broken Arrow. It's just outside of Tulsa. I said, I know. She said, I was like, yes.
Familiar.
Small sad world. It's not a sad thing. It's just the people that venture there and walk across its flat and dusty plains are a disappointment.
Yeah, that's true. Anyway, I thought when I saw that and I thought, holy cow, that is something that's in the, you know, world of what you and I have been advocating for pretty much from the beginning of this podcast. And if you want to break the circle of poverty, that's one of the first steps to doing it, is making sure that people's records are cleared. And the only people that will be able to look it up once it's expunged would be district attorneys and police forces.
That should be interesting to know exactly what kind of charges they're thinking about expunging. I'll put a pin in that. Do some research. Okay.
I hope it. That's a spark of light. Yeah. I just thought I would share something that's a small bit of good news.
It is. Look at Oklahoma. Look at the Sooner State.
I know. So what you got for us today?
Speaking of country, it's not really a WTF as much as it is just an observation of the whole current state of affairs of music. Unless everyone's been under rocks, you'll know that this lady named Beyonce dropped a couple of country singles. Matter of fact, she made the announcement during the Super Bowl when everybody's man Usher was up on stage. She said, oh, by the way, I'm doing country. And then she dropped two country songs and then said, I'm dropping a whole album in March. And of course, people lost their damn minds. It wasn't like she was already telegraphing this by the country cowboy hats that she had been wearing the last two or three times she had been seen publicly. But what do I know? And then immediately, the negativity starts across the socials.
I'm stunned.
She has no business making a country album. She's a pop singer. And of course, the one important point in all this kept going unspoken, but those of us who knew. Isn't that cultural appropriation? Like, there was more than one comment that literally said, isn't this the culture? And they were dead serious.
I mean, yeah.
Like, dude, she's from Houston, Texas. Grow up. One. Two, Black people have been involved in country since, I don't know, its inception. I don't care what you think you've read about it, because I guarantee you there are plenty of sources who love to leave out certain talking points when it comes to things like this. For instance, I looked up maybe two or three articles about it a couple weeks ago when all this kerfluffle was fresh.
Right.
Two of them said accurately, hey, influence of Africans and I believe it said Irish, so on and so forth. And then it migrated up. But they did mention enslaved Africans in two sources. The third said, it originated in the South and Southeastern part of the United States and migrated up into Virginia and West Virginia, into the Appalachians, where we got bluegrass. Conveniently left out the part about the contribution of Black folks.
Right.
Which again, I've seen quite a bit on a lot of genres of music, where if you know what you're talking about, you know what to look for. And then when it's not there, it's conspicuous. The absence of that information is conspicuous. So I said, just for kicks, everybody knows about a couple of Black country singers that were devoted primarily, or in one case specifically, solely to the country genre.
Right.
And I'll just say their names. Charlie Pride, who's been in country music for decades. He's been a mainstay. And then Hootie, Darius Rucker, lead singer of what used to be Hootie and the Blowfish.
Which Hootie! Apparently, apparently Hootie and the Blowfish are going on a reunion tour.
Are they?
This upcoming summer.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So a lot of people know those two names, but they don't know that there have been Black singers and musicians who, while they primarily stayed in a particular genre, ventured out with a couple of songs here and there over the years and sold dead off in the middle of the country genre where there's no mistaking what kind of songs they were. So I'll start off by mentioning Ray Charles, who came out with a hell fracking album in 1962 called Modern Sounds in Country and Western Music, which included one of my personal favorites, I Can't Stop Loving You, You Don't Know Me, and Born to Lose. Do you know Ray Charles? You know those songs? You're lying if you think that those aren't country songs.
Yeah, and him and Willie Nelson did an amazing song of Seven Spanish Angels.
Oh, I have to write that.
In the 80s, yeah.
Okay. The Pointer Sisters, those ladies that sang I'm So Excited, they also had a country song on the 1974 album, and the song was called Fairy Tale. Everybody's favorite American Idol judge, Lionel Richie himself, we've talked about him before. He's a favorite around here. When he first started his career, he was one of the lead singers with a group called the Commodores, and he wrote most of the songs for the Commodores. One of those songs was the one called Sail On in 1979. It is a beautiful song. Listening friends, if you've never heard it, shame on you. When he went solo, he wrote another country song called Stuck on You, and it has absolutely nothing to do with the movie. But Stuck on You is also a very pretty song. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah.
And matter of fact, Sail On charted as an R&B song. Stuck on You charted as R&B and country.
Yeah.
Aaron Neville of the Neville Brothers, he did a cover of George Jones's The Grand Tour, which I was just listening to before we went live, and it is an absolutely beautiful song. I like Aaron Neville. He has a very distinctive voice, but it is a beautiful song, and it's well done.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And last, and the only last, because these are the ones that jumped out at me first, Tina Turner. Her very first solo album, this is when she was still with Ike, her very first solo album was called Tina Turns the Country On, 1974, where she did covers of existing country songs. Go figure. And here's another interesting one. It was something I never considered, but it makes perfect sense. Her fifth album, which is the one that a lot of people know her for, Private Dancer, that's the one that contains the mega hit, What's Love Got to Do with It? Go back and listen to the song and tell me if you can't hear country. I'm saying.
Yeah.
We've been there. We've been there since the beginning. We're still there.
Now that I think about it, yeah. No, you're right. Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I just want to throw out there, though, that Lionel Richie, in terms of the upper echelon of music in general, is criminally underrated.
Underrated. And not only did he write songs for the Commodores in his health, he wrote songs for a lot of people. In particular, a mainstay of country music, our man Kenny Rogers.
Yep.
He wrote a song called Lady, Lionel Richie did, his song. Kenny Rogers, though, recorded it 20 years before Lionel Richie did. It was on Kenny Rogers' 1980 Greatest Hits album. And Lionel Richie produced it as well. And it hit number one on the country and Hot 100 and Adult Contemporary charts. I don't know what Adult Contemporary is supposed to mean. Is that supposed to be easy listening? Do they call it yacht rock now?
Perhaps.
That's probably what that is. They should just rename the chart yacht rock. And it's actually one of Kenny Rogers' biggest hits, which is absolutely correct. And like I said, Kenny did it in 1980. Richie did it almost 20 years later. And then they did a duet of it together, which sounds awesome. And the song is beautiful, regardless of who sings it. They both sing it really well.
For sure, definitely.
Song is gorgeous. So, yeah, black people have been in it. And I'm going to include, for listening friends, in our show notes, a link to something I just stumbled over, which is a list of 35 black country artists in the game right now. You might have heard of a few of them, but probably not most, because I hadn't heard of some of them. And that's going to be my musical voyage from here on out until whenever I get done, because these people are awesome. So that's it. I just need people to stop acting like this is a fucking world-altering event.
Right? And people need to quit locking people into musical genres based upon, the color of their skin. Right? Everybody can like every kind of music.
As long as you're not trying to mock it or denigrate the people,
Right.
that originated, as long as you handle it respectfully, I ain't got no problems with you. And then I think we talked about this like last year when we did the hip hop episode. We were talking about Eminem. That was the one thing he did not and has never done. A lot of people talk trash about him, but he's a good rapper. He never, ever, 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 ever tried to pretend he was someone he was not. Because a lot of them, they do that. Case in point, Mark Wahlberg.
I'm not arguing that point either. Well, I mean, sort of another example of that is failed rapper Robert Ritchie, also known as Kid Rock, because he tried to break into the rap scene before he did his blending of kind of rap and Lyndon
Hillbilly
Skynyrd.
rock. Hillbilly rock.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Before he kind of did that, and his was sort of more of a, I don't think that first thing was taken was a serious thing. But
Whatever.
anyway,
But yeah, there it is. We're all over the place. I don't know why people get so enraged and bent out of shape when we start talking about the full origins of certain things in this country. It's not taking away anything from, I guess in their minds it is. I guess in their minds it is taking away something. What that is, I
I have no idea either.
their identity?
I don't know. I don't. Sometimes the older I get, the more, and I think about things, the more it, like, the world just confuses me with why people do certain things and feel, certain ways
I mean,
about things.
you're right. Sometimes I'm like, huh? And like that post I had put up last week on my Facebook about the lady that I just happened to run into at Barnes and Noble, and me and her had sat there and had a conversation for like 30 some minutes. It was absolutely remarkable and fascinating just to come upon a complete stranger, and just fascinating. So it takes all kinds. And while humanity wouldn't be what it was if we didn't have all kinds, I'll put it that way.
Yeah, well, it's sort of like the thing that I posted on Facebook yesterday. There's no difference between the person who cosplays at a comic book convention or a Star Trek convention than the dude that wears a jersey to a sporting event. It's the same thing.
He thinks he's really playing.
Right, but the guy that goes to the, Dallas Cowboy game wearing his Dak Prescott jersey, he's cool, but the guy who dresses up as Picard at a Star Trek convention is a nerd and deserves to be mocked and made fun of. It's the same thing.
It's hilarious to me because of the care and the energy that goes into some of those costumes that cosplayers do. Some of that stuff is amazing.
I know. If anything,
Woo!
the sci-fi fantasy world cosplayer, they're the ones that need to be appreciated because the sports fan just buys it off a website, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, the cosplayer, mm-hmm. most of the time, made that crap themselves.
They ordered parts from here and there and everywhere and sat down for hours painting and gluing and sewing. And I have seen some amazing costumes.
Yeah, there are dudes that have Iron Man costumes mm-hmm. that have full like electrics and light. And these people mm-hmm. go and teach themselves freaking electronics just so this crap can light up and they make it all themselves. Mm-hmm. That's impressive.
It's very impressive.
Anybody can go on Amazon and click on a few clicks and order a jersey.
But then here's the trick. The people that cosplay don't at every particular point think they are actually in the story. Football fans that wear jerseys scream and throw Cheetos at each other.
Right?
When their team fumbles. They think they're in the game.
Or in Philadelphia, throw snowballs at Santa.
Yeah. They really think, like, you let that get to you. You don't, shut up. Anyway.
But yeah.
The point has been made.
It's the same thing, folks.
It is the same thing.
And it's, you know, that crosses multiple things. It doesn't matter if somebody can do a country album, if the songs are, you know, well sung, well written, and the instruments are well played, more power to you.
And quite frankly, I don't think I have, out of the handful of current country singers that I've heard, I haven't heard a one that was bad or that was like mediocre. They all sound awesome. Like, I just listened to this one young lady the other day. She literally does, somebody called it trap country. I was like, because they dropped a bass line in the first verse. I was like, oh, she was good. She was good. I was like, wait a minute. I said, let me go ahead and rearrange myself and put all these things on my playlists.
Yep. Yep.
I am behind. But there it is. There it is.
There it is. Yeah. And that ties in perfectly to this month, the theme of this month. We are calling it Musical March.
Woo woo. Woo woo woo. Woo.
We are going to discuss music all month. And if you've listened to this podcast any length of time, you know that both of us hate music. Neither one of us have gone to any concerts. We don't enjoy listening to music at all times. The fact that we did a 50th anniversary of hip hop and a special on Thriller, that's just coincidental.
It is. We abhor it. We absolutely hate it. We listen to dead silence and ambient sounds when we work.
Yep. That is 100% true.
Oh, so we're cosplaying like we're music lovers.
Yes.
Oh, but, my goodness. So
yeah. Yeah. So I was gonna kick it off.
Yeah.
And I have been to a pretty large number of concerts in my life, and I was gonna go through it was initially going to be my top five. However, in the number five slot, there's a tie. So technically, I guess it's kind of a top six. The first concert that I went to was in high school a few moons ago. To this day, I am still irritated with my mom because in ninth grade, a friend of mine had tickets to go see Def Leppard.
No.
His big brother, I don't remember what had happened. Him and his big brother were going and another friend, and his big brother was sick, broke his arm, something. I don't remember. And he had the spare ticket and he asked if I wanted to go. And my mom wouldn't let me because my mom. In hindsight, I shouldn't have been honest and I should have said we were going to do something else and just gone to the concert.
No. I cannot condone teenage lying. But my question is, though, wasn't Def Leppard the band with the one-armed drummer?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. I wasn't sure. That man can play his ass off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty impressive that he was able to adapt and continue doing that afterwards. Because
that just lets you know how much he loved it.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other impressive thing is that the band waited for him to heal and teach himself to drum again. Mm-hmm. A lot of bands would have just fired him or got a new drummer and did certain things. And they did not do that. But that could have been my very first concert. Mm-hmm. It was not. I actually think my first concert ended up being one of the times I've seen Motley Crue.
Oh, wow.
That was at the old State Fairgrounds racetrack that they used to have concerts in.
Wow.
Tommy Lee threw a drumstick into the audience. I stuck my arm up, and lo and behold, I caught the damn thing.
You still have it?
No, because like 18 people jumped on top of me, and some dude ripped it out of my hand.
So you didn't even walk out of the stage?
No. With it. No. Jesus. But I did put a cigarette out in his neck, so.
Fair's fair.
I figured that was a fair trade, right? But yeah, I've been to a lot. I've seen, I saw Queensryche, you know, the song Silent Lucidity. It was an interesting concert. The funny thing about Queensryche now is they tour with the original lead singer was kicked out of the band. And so he tours and sings all the Queensryche stuff as Jeff Tate of Queensryche. And then Queensryche tours with their new replacement lead singer as Queensryche. I just find all of that somewhat funny.
That's interesting that he even let him use the name in that capacity.
I imagine there were probably some court proceedings involved.
Like they had two Temptations groups there for a while?
Yeah. Yeah. I can't remember who it was. There was some guy. It was some lesser heavy metal hair band from the late 80s. And the dude that founded the band, the rest of them kicked him out. And then they sued him when he tried to tour using his own last name.
That actually sounds like a part of the Temptation story. it literally does. Like their first manager gave them a name, and then she supposedly screwed them out of their money. And then they parted ways, but they couldn't even take the name. She said, "That's my name. I came up with that." So they had to think of a whole new name.
My gosh.
Yeah. That's the music business, man.
But yeah, I've been to lots of concerts through the years. The band that I have seen the most in concert is the Flaming Lips. I've seen them 5 times, 5 years in a row.
Mm.
They used to do a concert every New Year's Eve that was their New Year's Eve concert. And so you would bring in the New Year's with the Flaming Lips. And one of the reasons they did it at the time is, of course, the Flaming Lips are from Oklahoma City, and the lead singer liked the fact that he could go to a concert and then he could drive home on New Year's Eve and just be home the next day for New Year's Day.
No, that's nice.
And so I like that. Plus, the Flaming Lips are one of my favorite bands. If you don't know who the Flaming Lips are, I'm sorry. They're unique. If you've ever heard She Don't Use Jelly, that would be the Flaming Lips.
Here's something I didn't know until the other day. One of my personal faves, Miss Erykah Badu of Dallas, Texas, actually did a song with them. She has, I did a little write-up for Black History Month on her for my job.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through all the songs that she's featured on.
Mm-hmm.
And she was on one of their songs. I said, "Get the hot toast out of here. I'm going to find it here in a minute." Oh, the first time ever I saw your face, which is a Roberta Flack song.
Right.
Yes, I did not know that. And I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm going to. I found it absolutely fascinating because she features on just the most random.
Right.
People's
when did that tracks. One come out, by the way? Is that pre-99?
2012. Oh,
2012?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because they went through the Lips went through a period of time where they did a bunch of like sort of one-shot releases. And that's probably when that one came out.
You know what? I stand. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say the Flaming Lips have done some interesting stuff in 96-ish, 97-ish. They released something called Zarika. And the only way that you're supposed to listen to it is you get four CD players. You have them facing each other. You sit in the middle and you push play on all four of them, and it tells you which disc to push play first. And that's how you hear the fullness of the album. Talk about concept crazy album. That's taking it to the extreme right there. I don't even know how you could do that in the world of streaming services nowadays, because I don't even know if they've gone back and mixed it as like one thing.
Okay, I'm curious now.
They also 2016-ish, they released a 24-hour long song. Yeah.
Were there vocals?
I don't remember, because I've honestly never made it past like the first half hour. I love the Flaming Lips, but I still haven't decided to take the bullet on that one for some weird reason. I don't know why.
But if you ever, I don't know that you would, but if you just feel frisky one day, you ever want to experience something really, some type of creative, something that's really long and doesn't seem to have any particular point, but it's fascinating. There's a 1980s movie. It's called Koyaanisqatsi.
Okay.
It's 4 hours long. And I'm going to tell you. 1982 film. Koyaanisqatsi. And, subtitled Life Out of Balance. And all it is just a series of like small scenes of things in motion.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Like they have one where you get several minutes of a traffic jam on a highway.
Interesting.
And let me see. Oh, Koyaanisqatsi is a Hopi word meaning life out of bounds. That's where it got the subtitle. But it's interesting because, like I said, there's no dialogue. There's no narrator, nothing. It's just visual images of stuff.
Right.
So you literally turn it on and leave the room, or just turn it on for background while you do something else and just come and go. And then you might actually see something and you just sit there and watch and you're like. And the only reason I know about it is because one of my professors in school insisted that we see this movie. He didn't show it to us, but he said, y'all need to go see it. And I ended up finding it. I think I ended up finding it on VHS at the local video store. So, yeah. I am familiar with really, 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 really long pieces of art.
But anyway, I guess I should get into what I was going to talk about, though.
Okay.
Although I will say the Flaming Lips do have a theme song from a movie, and it might be the only theme song that the chorus has cussing. It's from that movie, what is it, Unlucky Chuck or whatever it was, with that one comedian, Dane.
Oh, Good Luck Chuck.
Good Luck Chuck, yeah. They did the theme song for that, and it's called Super Lucky. Mm-hmm. And the chorus line is, you lucky motherfucker, going on in the background. And I'm like, I'm shocked that that made it through. I don't know if someone was listening when they submitted that song to be the theme song for that. But
interesting.
There you go. There probably aren't a whole lot of bands that said, hey, we want you to do a song for a movie. And they're like, how many times can we put motherfucker in that song?
That reminds me of that song they used to have on, what's the animated show? South Park.
Yeah.
Shut your fucking mouth, Uncle Fucker. That was the name of the song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm curious. I've heard you mention them before. Okay. Now for real, I'm going to have to go listen to them because reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. And they've been around forever. Their first album came out in 86.
Yes. I just happened to be looking them up when you were talking about them. I'm like, well, I'll be doggone. Like, I've heard you talking about them. I've heard them in other places. I just never.
Yeah. And
Never listened. Or I might have heard a song and just didn't know.
One of their band members, Stephen Draws, that dude is similar to Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails and Prince, and that he can play like 25 different instruments.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I think it's their album At War with Mystics. I believe he played every single instrument, and the bass player almost quit over it.
Why does that remind me of, what's the band, Rush? For some reason, I don't know how I stumbled across them. I think I was reading something and they were talking about the lead singer and guitarist or whatever. So I looked him up and then I came across one of their songs. I was like, yo, they're pretty fucking good.
Yeah. So anyway, I know the Flaming Lips aren't for everybody. I'll get to that a little more. Let's get to my top six.
Okay.
I'm going to go with this one first, because the next one is somewhat surprising that it's tied with. But in 1993, I saw Nirvana about 4 months before his fatal day.
You must have went to the same concert my coworker went to. 93?
Probably, yeah. It was like December of 93.
Yep, it was. It was the same concert. Because he came back like he had just seen God himself descend from heaven.
It was incredible. The concert was incredible.
He was geeked.
Yeah, it was fantastic. The cool thing about Cobain was, you know, the modern thing in concerts now, and even kind of back then, was in between songs that the guitars were tuned different. Someone brings out the guitar that's tuned for that particular song. He'd just stop and go, hang on. And he would like adjust the guitar to tune it to the next song. And then they would go in and play it. But yeah, it was absolutely incredible. The Breeders opened up for him. Their hit from the 90s was Cannonball. And the actual opening band was an all-female heavy metal band from Japan that spoke no English.
Did you remember what their names were?
I do not. I have no idea. But they were good. Couldn't understand a word they were saying, obviously. But in terms of the quality of playing instruments and the music and everything, they were very, very good.
That's fascinating. I gotta look into that.
The concert itself was incredible. Yeah, I could see why your friend was over the over the moon from that concert. Like, it was incredible.
He was bananas. And then when, you know, Cobain died, that poor boy came into work. Like, he had been crying all night long.
I can understand.
He was devastated. This is the same kid when who's the singer? Eddie Vedder. Who was he with?
Pearl Jam.
When Pearl Jam came, he went to go see Pearl Jam. He came in like the next Monday. His name was also Eddie. So he came in. We went to go see Pearl Jam over the weekend. I said, how was it? Like, he's got, you know, the big eyes that Puss in Boots had when he's looking up and trying to make somebody soft. He had those big glassy eyes. He was like, I touched Eddie. I was like, you touched yourself? He was like, what? He didn't even get what I said.
Right. You know, it's funny you bring that out, because when the grunge scene hit, sort of the four big grunge bands were Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains.
Mm.
And of those four bands, Eddie's the only lead singer left.
Oh, wow. Who was Soundgarden? Oh!
Chris Cornell.
Yes! Oh, yeah.
Elaine Staley from Alice in Chains.
Wow. That guy could, his voice was something else. The Soundgarden lead singer?
Yeah, Chris Cornell. Yeah, there's a reason his nickname was the Banshee.
He's no joke.
No.
He was no joke on the mic. Oh, boy. That's... That's wild. That's wild.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. But that was definitely interesting. One thing, though, I've always wanted to ask Dave Grohl, because I'm kind of torn, because Dave Grohl with the Foo Fighters has put out some incredible music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Incredible music. As a matter of fact, I recently saw a story with the fourth member of Nirvana, Pat Smear. And yes, that's his name.
I didn't say.
And they were recording one of the Nirvana albums, and they were taking a break. And Pat Smear and Kurt Cobain were walking down the hallway, and they heard like this. They said just this killer guitar solo. Never heard this song before. It was, they're like, they could tell it was original. They walked by and they looked in the room, and it was Dave Grohl playing the guitar.
Oh, wow.
And then Kurt turned to Pat and goes, I think he's the best guitar player in the band. You know, and he was the drummer.
Oh, geez.
And I've always wanted to ask Dave if he would have stayed in Nirvana or if he would eventually put out solo work, because he had all of that stuff in him. Because after Kurt Cobain died, he went to the recording studio and recorded the first Foo Fighters album, but he didn't want anyone to know it was him. And that's why he called it Foo Fighters, which were like ghost fighter planes from World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody loved it. All of a sudden he got an offer to sign, and then he had to throw a band together.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's one of the few cases where the band came afterwards. And so I wonder if he would have put out solo albums, because he had all of that stuff written, but he was too embarrassed to bring it up because he just loved Kurt so much.
Mm-hmm.
So I've often wondered if he would have stayed with Nirvana, put out some solo music on the side.
He may have gone solo later.
But yeah, if I could ever talk to Dave Grohl, that would be the question I'd ask him.
Who's the drummer for Foo Fighters?
It was Tyler. He just died 2 years ago.
Oh, we talked about him.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh.
We Tyler, I can't. And then when they did the tribute album, his son played drums on.
All right. Yeah, we talked about that. I'm thinking there's a drummer. It's going to come to me once we get done. There's a drummer.
I mean, when else would it?
It always does. He, for the life of me, I see his face because he looks just like Will Ferrell.
Oh, yeah, that's the drummer for the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
He has a thing on a TikTok channel where he'll listen to a song with the drum track dropped out.
And then he has to do the drums. Yeah.
He is amazing.
Half the time, his drums are better than what's on there. But sometimes he'll start doing the drums, and it's kind of crazy how close he gets to the actual drum track on some of those.
Because he did, when I looked at, he did a 30 Seconds to Mars song. And I was like,
yeah,
holy shit. That's a musician, period.
Oh,
like,
yeah, yeah, definitely.
I'm like, I almost envy having that kind of skill. I really do.
Right, yeah. So,
All right,
I will go on for the tie with Nirvana. And mm-hmm. This one may come as a shock for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Neil Diamond, 2009.
There's no shock whatsoever.
My mom was a huge, huge Neil Diamond fan. She'd never had an opportunity to see him in concert. That particular year, they announced that he was going to be coming in October and like March. I immediately went and bought two tickets to give to my mother as a Mother's Day gift. And so on Mother's Day, we go to see her, and I was like, so, Mom, I've got you this excellent present, but you're not going to get to cash in on it until October. So she kind of had this look on her face. And then I said, we're going to go see Neil Diamond. And she was like, I would have waited until Mother's Day next year to get to see him. Growing up, we were allowed to listen to country because that's what my pop listened to. Christian music, because that's what Mom listened to. And Neil Diamond, because my mom loved Neil Diamond.
Oh, I love it.
It's so I took her to that concert, and I will never forget that the concert was pretty much exclusively boomers that were still married. Boomers whose Gen X child took them to see Neil Diamond, and that was pretty much it. But that man puts on a show. Well, at least he did. He's retired. But that man put on a show, and you have never lived until you hear 20,000 people singing Sweet Caroline in unison. That was amazing. Neil Diamond was in his 70s, and that dude was running around on stage.
Those old school performers, I don't know how they do it. They get up there and they're stone cold. Like, hear this from a lot of people. Charlie Wilson, the lead singer from the Gap Band.
Yeah.
He puts on a show, I hear. And he's around that age as well, in his 70s. I hear he puts on a hell of a show.
The way he ran around, I was like, well, no wonder he ain't fat. he put in about a marathon's worth of running around in that concert. His voice, no different between the studio recording and live. It was just that perfect and brilliant and smooth. Every song he sang was fantastic. It just hearing all of that, and then the atmosphere with all of the people there, you know, just being major fans. It was just really cool. And then, of course, there's, you know, the added benefit of getting to take my mom to a lifelong dream of hers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also. Damn, so
I love it.
I could see why on Saving Silverman they love Neil Diamond the way they did. I don't know if you remember that movie.
Who was in there?
Dang it, why is my mind drawing a blank? It's where they kidnap her. It's the dude from American Pie.
Yeah.
He was in it. Steven something. Anyway, good movie. And then Arlie Ermey was in it as well. He was a side character.
Okay. The title sounds familiar, but...
Yeah, if you like IMDb it, you'll remember it and be like, oh yeah. But yeah, so Neil Diamond, 2009. Coming in at number 4, an artist that most people probably have not heard of, but I absolutely love him, which is strange because he's kind of folk, adult contemporary, I guess. He is an Irish artist by the name of Glenn Hansard. When he was 19 years old, he was in the movie The Commitments that came out in 94-ish about the Irish blues band with one of the great lines where they're like, isn't that black people music? And he goes, hey, the Irish, we're the black people of Europe. I was like, he ain't wrong.
There actually is a band right now that covers old R&B that's Irish. I have to go look them up too. They're amazing. I'm like, what the?
But at the time, he was actually in a band called The Frames, which was more UK popular than here. And then he made a second movie called Once. And Once actually won an Academy Award for Best Song from a Movie. Hmm. And then they turned it into a Broadway musical in the year that it was in the Tonys that are the Broadway Awards? Yeah. It won like 12 awards that year for the play Once, which was essentially the movie. Once was filmed illegally in Dublin. So a lot of times it was one take because they had to film
it run.
Before the cops came.
Yeah. Do we get it? Go.
Yeah. And it was made with a musician named Marita Erglova, who's Czechoslovakian, and her family had moved to Ireland, but she is a piano prodigy. And then after the movie came out, those two formed like a band called The Swell Season. And then after that, he started releasing solo albums. He did the theme song from The Odd Life of Timothy Green called This Gift. Mm-hmm. Which was cool for a while when he toured it. They would get in touch with local schools and have their choirs learn the song. And when he performed it, they would come and perform it in the background.
Oh, nice.
Which I always thought was kind of cool. But Glenn Hansard, when he sings, every song he is singing is like he like full on expects to die at the end of the song. And he is putting everything he has into every song as he's singing it live. And he's another one of those artists that sounds, he actually, I think, almost sounds better live than he does on the studio versions because of the emotion he puts into the song.
There are some artists that do that. Yes.
And he has like 5 solo albums now. But I absolutely love him. This Gift is an amazing song. He has an amazing song called My Little Ruin. And I love the way that when he's live, he talks about it. He's like, we all have that one friend who's an awesome friend and you love. And they always have a way of seeming to fuck everything up. And he's all, but you love him and you always are there for him. And he's like, and that's what this song is about.
That's cute.
Yeah. And he remade a Bruce Springsteen song and his version of it is better.
Interesting.
And then he was at a concert and one of his life goals was Springsteen came out and sang it with him.
Nice.
Which was cool. And he's also done music with Eddie Vedder.
Oh, okay. I see that the movies on Peacock.
Once or The Commitments?
Once.
Yeah, it's worth watching, I will say. Glenn Hansard is a better musician than he is an actor.
Sometimes it's like that.
But yeah, it definitely can introduce you, though, into a lot of the music that he has performed. And he's a hell of a writer, hell of a singer, hell of a live performer. I've actually seen him twice. I saw him up in Tulsa. I took off work early, got there at like 4 o'clock and was the fourth person in line. And then a couple years ago, they came back. Well, here's the funny thing. My wife and I went with another friend. And when we got there, some friends of his walked up and were in line behind us. So then we became like Facebook friends with them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So what, 5 years later, he comes to Oklahoma City and I take off. This time I'm first in line. And then all of a sudden we hear some people coming and we turn around and it's them from the other concert. So we hung out again for this whole other concert. And it was really cool. And both times, because it was sort of the older venues where it's not actual seats and it's first come, first serve. So both times we were right up front on the guardrails, getting to see him just that close. And it was just incredible. And was it the first time I saw him? It was right after Gene Wilder had died. And he did a tribute to him where they sang one of the songs from Willy Wonka.
Interesting. Okay.
That Gene Wilder had sung. But yeah, Glenn Hansard, in my opinion, worth it. There are tons of his stuff on YouTube where you can go and watch his videos, especially the live versions. I recommend seeing the live version just because of the passion involved.
Okay. I'll make a note. So what's your number 4?
Number 3. Mm-hmm. Technically number 3 is Counting Crows.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Another band that I have seen twice, but this is specifically the first time that we saw them in 2014. Once again, some of it is because there is an emotional tie to it. Way back when Heather and I were just dating. A little band called Counting Crows came out with a little tiny song called Mr. Jones. And it was played all over MTV and VH1, all over the radio. We both liked that song. So got to date myself even more. Got the cassette. And I actually then ended up having to buy a second cassette because Heather liked it so much that we both needed a copy of it. And we probably both of us played those cassettes to death to where they quit playing. Whole album. Loved every single song on August and everything after. That's that first album.
Pop the tape.
And then, I mean, we just listened to that thing just so much. Upgraded to the CD. And then their second CD, Recovering the Satellites, came out. I think that was 90... Actually, I think August and Everything After came out in 92 or 3, and it was 94-ish when Recovering the Satellites came out. Anyway, always loved them, listened to their music all the time. Every time a new CD came out, we would purchase it. But due to the fact that, you know, we had young kids, we always put our kids first. We didn't go to many concerts in those days. And the times that they came to Oklahoma City, we just weren't able to go to concert to see them. And so in 2014, they came through and we were able to go see him. And that was kind of like, you know, like a lifelong thing, because they had effectively been in our lives the entire time of our marriage, right? And Heather loves them. And there were about, I don't even remember what the song was, but they started playing one of the songs. And I looked over and she was so happy. She was actually crying of tears of joy because she was getting to hear the song live. And that was like a super extra special moment.
I've done that. I've done that a time or two.
For me, I almost, man, I'm sounding like a weenie. That's because I'm a beta male. Joke, folks. But seeing her like that emotional, because it was something similar to like my mom that she had wanted to see for all of this time, and then to finally get to see it live in that particular song, which was one of her favorite songs, you know, and then they played it. Because, you know, by that time, they had a bunch of songs they could have put on their set list and, you know, not necessarily play one of the songs that you love. And so getting her to see her be like that emotional, but out of joy, was just a really cool experience. And then afterwards, I commented on their Facebook page, because they always, you know, would post some pictures that, hey, we were here, great show, yada, yada, yada. And I just commented, and I, in a Cliff Notes version of what I just said, sort of typed that out. And I wasn't expecting anything. And I even said, look, I know that you guys are busy, and I'm not expecting anything. I just wanted to share this. The drummer replied. And he's like, that is such an incredible story. I'm glad you shared it. And we read every comment on our Facebook. And I was like, that is really, really cool.
That's nice.
Yeah. Now, since then, we've seen him a second time last September, actually. We saw him for the second time. Mm-hmm. So that was also an excellent concert. I mean, every much as bit as fun as the first time. You know, Heather enjoyed it just as much. It's just, it was slightly different because it wasn't like finally getting to see all of this stuff live after all these years. So there's that. Now I shall move on to number two. Mm-hmm. That is, as I mentioned earlier, I've seen the Flaming Lips 5 times. This one was the third time that I saw them. It was the 2012 New Year's Eve concert. And this one was different. They did their normal concert. And then after midnight, because in Oklahoma City, you can't have concerts that go past midnight. But they got a special permit, and they performed the album, The Soft Bulletin, in its entirety. Which was cool. But the main reason I love it is because it was Duncan and Emily's first concert.
Oh, okay. That'll do it.
Emily, actually, now that I think about it, it was probably the 2011 version, because Emily was 11. If you know M, you know that she dances to the beat. Well, she's not even in drums. She's in a different instrument section entirely, right? You know, she doesn't dance to the beat of a different drummer. It's different instruments. Emily has always been herself, and she's always been unique. And when she was that age, when other kids were listening to Miley Cyrus and all of these, Emily was listening to the Flaming Lips. And so we took her, and I would like to say, yes, we knew that there was going to be a lot of weed smoking. We bought an N95 mask and made her wear it during the concert to filter some of that out. If you know anything about a Flaming Lips concert, there are confetti factories that are in business to this day due to the amount of confetti that they shoot out. They have confetti cannons. They have confetti guns. Mm-hmm. When they are done, the floor underneath the stage is about a good solid 2 inches of confetti, and I am not I am not exaggerating that amount. It is a good 2 solid inches of confetti.
Interesting.
They also have hundreds of gigantic balloons that just get bounced around as they're going. Emily went and got one, hung it up on her ceiling, and it stayed with air for like a good 4 years. Kind of crazy.
Interesting.
But she absolutely loved that concert. And as we were in line getting to go in, there were all of the Flaming Lips fans are called the Fearless Freaks, and they're all sort of unique people. And they were all dressed similar to how Em was. And she goes, Dad. I was like, what? She's like, I finally found my people. And I was like, yes, you have. And so that was just really cool getting to watch her experience that. Duncan, mm-hmm. too, loves the Flaming Lips. It was just slightly different for Em because she felt like for the first time in her life that she was at home, you know? And she has also got to meet the lead singer of the Flaming Lips, Wayne Coyne. The museum did a big event with the Flaming Lips one time. And she was probably 9, and she walked up to him, and she started kind of like punching him in the stomach. And he looked down, and she goes, the Flaming Lips are my favorite band. And he goes, oh. And I had a feeling he probably thought that, like, we put her up to that or something. And then she looked at him, and she goes, my favorite songs are Yoshimi Battles the Pink Robots, the Yeah, Yeah, Yeah song, and This Here Giraffe. When she mentioned the third song, This Here Giraffe, he knew that she was, in fact, not put up to it by her parents. And he leaned down and said to her, he goes, if This Here Giraffe is one of your favorite songs, you truly are a Flaming Lips fan.
It's cute.
So, yeah, that's just sort of a great deal. Now, she did not make it all the way through the soft bulletin after midnight. She fell asleep sitting in my lap. But, you know, she was like 11. So, what are you going to do? But yeah, that was an excellent time. Love that. Never forget it. Every concert from the Flaming Lips I enjoy. That one's just kind of extra special for that reason. And the second one in line of Flaming Lips would be when I got the press. Heather and I got the press pass to take pictures for the thing at the museum. And Heather got to go on stage and take pictures during the concert. That was like a lifelong dream for her. So that's like one, you know, 2B on that thing for that reason. I went for the concert, but technically I was there to take pictures. So I was in the backstage on the side, snapping pictures the whole time, but not really. So we're running out of time here. Going over. Number one for me.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone knows I love Pink Floyd. Roger Waters' Toward the Wall, 2014. Considering that you will never get to see a Pink Floyd concert again after 2008, that's the closest that I was ever going to get to seeing Pink Floyd in concert that does not involve DVD or Blu-ray. I was very happy to have gotten to have seen that, and it is everything that I thought it would be. I got to see the wall get built throughout the whole concert, which is sort of a unique concept because kind of starts out singing it, and these people come and they just start building this wall through the whole thing. And at the end of it, the wall is something like 25 feet high. And so the rest of the band is performing behind the wall and you can't see him. And sometimes he comes out and these little vignette things come out and pop out. And there are all these blow ups that go, you know, that float around through the stage. Some of them pop up and do the thing. It's very theatrical.
It's it's not the exact same thing, but I find that kind of fascinating when you have one thing that's like the main part of the performance, and then there's something else on the periphery happening at the same time. We saw a dance company that did that once, where like the main troupe of dancers, they had like, I think the whole show had like 7 or 8 pieces, but right. The entire time there was one dancer that's made their way around the entire stage, just walking
slowly
the entire show. So by the time the entire show was done, which was like an hour and change, they had come back to the other.
Right.
And we were like, we couldn't figure it out, but it was fascinating.
Yeah.
I find those kinds of things like it adds some zhuzh, because you're like, why are they doing this thing? And then after a while, you don't care why they're doing it. You just know you like
Yeah, yeah.
it.
The other sort of unique thing about that is technically only Roger Waters can tour and sing the entirety of The Wall. Even though it's a Pink Floyd album, he wrote it. And when they divorced and they had their horrible breakup, and
You
one of
got
the
custody.
he got custody. Pink Floyd, there are about five songs from The Wall that they can perform. But in terms of doing it in its entirety, Roger Waters owns it, and he's the only one that can do it in its entirety. So that's the closest you could get to even sort of seeing it anyway. And the one thing I was kind of wondering, they have an inflatable sort of deal that they have. It's a flying pig from their animals deal. And believe it or not, that was one of the big points of contention after they broke up and they left the band, was he
Pick.
said that the rest of the band couldn't use the flying pig in concert because after he left, they released a new album, and when they toured, they had a flying pig. And he was like, "You can't do that. This is my idea." And the judge actually ended up making a ruling on it. And the ruling was that Pink Floyd can have a flying pig as well, but that it has to be made noticeably male.
So,
So
never
Roger's flying pig is
mind.
female, and Pink Floyd's flying pig is noticeably male. Not just male,
Noticeably.
noticeably.
So they literally took that to heart, pretty
Yeah,
much
they
as a,
spent like 7 years in court.
I mean, as far as, you want it to look noticeably like a male,
Yeah.
we'll give you exactly what y'all asked for. That must have been delightful.
Yeah, and it's really strange because Roger Waters and Dave Gilmour, they did not talk for a long time. Then in 2006, they were convinced to come and perform four songs at Live 8 to raise money for whatever it was they were raising money for. And that was the last time that the entirety of the band played together because about 4 years later, the keyboardist Richard Wright died of cancer. And then they quit talking again. And then they did some charity stuff. And then they quit talking. And then in that 2014 concert tour, they actually worked it out where Dave Gilmour was going to come and play Comfortably Numb in like seven cities on the tour. But it was random and nobody knew what they were doing. And I knew that David Gilmour was not going to fly to Tulsa, Oklahoma to perform Comfortably Numb. Right? I knew that. But there was still like 2% of me that was hoping. But didn't happen. It was one of those things for me, much like my mom and Heather, that sort of fulfilled a lifelong dream. It fulfilled a lifelong dream for me to get to see that. And that's why it's my number one.
Lovely.
I selfishly made something that was about me number one. I mean, they were all about me, but that one was mainly musically about my tastes and likes.
I mean, as long as you're honest with yourself, that's what matters here.
Yes, but still an excellent concert.
Listening, friends, if that last hour and change is not proof of the fact that we absolutely abhor the noise that is called music, then nothing will.
That's right. And I apologize for rambling on.
No, it's
We're weak
fine.
Tibetic.
It's fine. Like if something like music doesn't cause some level of sentimentality or emotion in you, then you're just dead inside and I don't want to talk to you anyway.
Right. There
Yes.
are a list of artists that I want to see in concert. That could be, a topic for a different time. But I would like to say that Outkast, if you guys could please tour. I have never got to see you,
Me
and
neither.
you need to tour and come to Oklahoma City so I can see you. That's the only reason why.
Yeah, they ain't never getting back together.
Long as they're not on Roger and Dave Gilmour term, we can hope that maybe,
I
just
mean,
maybe.
as far as I know, they're still amicable. So,
Yeah, probably won't be playing any flute music.
I mean, you never know. I'm going to make this real quick because we got to wrap up.
I actually like that CD. So
I do. But here's the thing, that whole, when people lost their cotton picking fluffing minds over that, and he just came out of nowhere just doing something completely different. One, he's a musician. He can do what he wants. He's already cemented his place in music history.
Great. Okay?
Not hip-hop history, music history. Him, Antoine Patton, are icons. Shut up. He can do what he wants. Secondly, they clearly had not been paying attention to the trajectory that his career had been taking for some years.
Right.
Because the second to last album that he did, which was the double album, his part was called The Love Below.
Right.
And he did some very experimental stuff on that. One of those tracks near the end of it was a jazz fusion hip hop version of My Favorite Things.
Yeah.
I bring that up as an example. I brought it up as an example every time I responded to somebody crying about, you know, Andre did this abrupt turning and this weird pan flute music. I was like, right. You're an idiot and you were not a fan because you would have seen him already evolving to this.
Yeah.
Years ago.
And if anybody thinks I'm pandering, know that my email address is a tribute to Andre 3000.
Tis. So I had to get that out though for all the for all the children that don't understand what that means.
That's it, my top six concerts.
Mm-hmm.
Glad I got to share those. Glad I got to explain why they were all, you know, what they meant to me and why they were in that state. Don't get me wrong, I love every concert I've been to.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me rephrase that. Except for Aerosmith, they sucked.
Oh.
That's the one exception. Probably not the band people would think I would say sucked live, but they did. But anyway, yeah, there's that. And I'm looking forward to what Kenyatta has in store for us next week when she talks about her love of, I mean, her hatred of music.
My hatred, my absolute hatred of music, and my especially vehement hatred of a classic album / movie. But you hear all about it. And also, just to end this, I have seen R. Kelly in concert. I'll stop there. We'll go ahead and wrap up.
With that, if you enjoy what we're doing, please go to buymeacoffee.com/hyperfocuspot. And any support you give us, we will appreciate. And with that, bye.
And now, folks, it's time to say goodnight. We sincerely appreciate your patronage and hope we've succeeded in bringing you an enjoyable evening of entertainment. Please drive home carefully and come back again soon. Good night.